From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the anti-gerrymandering proposal makes it to the November ballot.
People want a new process that puts people first and puts voters back in charge instead of politicians.
Michiganders should study carefully every ballot proposal, especially amendments to the state constitution.
Why NASA has cast its research eye on a little island in Lake Superior.
And one of the reasons we're really interested in that for Lake Superior is it's warming very rapidly. It's one of the most rapidly warming lakes on the planet.
The daredevil Michigander who became the first female pilot licensed in the USA.
Her flying spoke for itself. When she first started, she would wear a veil to try to hide her gender, but she was very good.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The legal challenges are over. The voters of Michigan will have our chance to decide whether we want an independent commission to draw our legislative districts instead of the party in power. On a 4-3 vote, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that the voters, not politicians, proposal may indeed appear on the November ballot. The court rejected a challenge that Proposal B was too broad and needed a constitutional convention. Katie Fahey is with us, executive director of Voters, Not Politicians. Katie, the ruling came down last night. Two justices appointed by Democrats, two appointed by Republicans, and they voted to keep this anti-gerrymandering proposal on the ballot. How do you feel about that?
I feel amazing. It is so nice to, you know, we've been working on this for over a year and a half, and to now be able to just focus on November 6th and reaching those voters to vote yes, it feels incredible. And I think having two Democrats and two Republicans validate this through the Supreme Court also just feels wonderful to show that, you know, we can come together and people can put state over party.
So now you know it's a go for November, and now you have to fight for a yes vote. What is the message that you plan to put out there for voters?
You know, really, it all comes back to our name. It's, you know, do you think voters should choose their politicians, or do you think politicians should choose their voters? And what we have heard across the state with thousands of volunteers from hundreds of thousands of signatures, tens of thousands of donations, is that people want a new process that puts people first and puts voters back in charge instead of politicians.
How prepared are you for deep-pocketed opponents? I guess I'm wondering, how much is Voters, Not Politicians prepared to spend to get that message out?
We're going to be working to spend and to raise as much as we can. You know, what we've been able to do, we started from a Facebook post, and what we've been able to do so far is we've already knocked over 88,000 doors going door to door talking to people about Proposal 2, what an independent citizens redistricting commission means for them, you know, for Michigan. So we'll keep doing that because we know that the opposition, who's already reared their head through the courts, traditionally has funded up into the, you know, 30 million mark in elections like this. But we're prepared to meet them head to head, and we're not going anywhere anytime soon.
Speaking of this starting as a Facebook post, the July 22nd New York Times had an editorial titled Do-It-Yourself Legislative Redistricting, and that's where I read how you began with all of this, this effort that coalesced into Voters, Not Politicians, right after the November 2016 election.
Yeah. And during the 2016 election, I saw friends and family that I normally don't see paying attention to politics actually engaging, and engaging in a way where they were talking about the differences between, you know, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump's healthcare policies, which I've never seen. And I've always been begging my family to want to pay attention and engage in. And when I took a step back to think about, you know, why is this election so different? I really think it was because you had Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump as these politicians who were really talking about the need for reform and the need to redo some of our systems and take the way that things have, quote unquote, always been done to be more accountable to people, to drain the swamp, or whatever phrases were being used. And after the election, I saw, though, those friends and family kind of go back to the you're a Democrat or you're a Republican camps. We weren't talking about policy anymore. It was more gloating or crying. And so thinking about Thanksgiving dinner, I wanted an issue that we could all talk about and be able to work on together, because it really wasn't about the individual politician. It really was about the issues and people wanting accountability, people wanting to be heard. And that's how I ended up on redistricting. So I kind of threw the question out there. If you want to, you know, take on gerrymandering, why don't we fight for something that's just good for all voters, that takes the power back away from politicians, and made a Facebook post. And somehow now we've, you know, made it through all of this, through the Supreme Court, and now people will be able to vote on Proposal 2 in November.
Now that the state Supreme Court, Katie, has essentially pulled the plug on the opposition's argument that this proposal should have been done through a constitutional convention, that argument's already shifting. We're hearing the argument that this proposal will change too much of the structure of the state's governing structure, and outsiders shouldn't be shaping our districts. How do you respond?
You know, yesterday's decision put the rule of law ahead of the rule of money. And although that money hasn't disappeared and they're going to try and get people to vote no, there was a very clear decision, not only from the Court of Appeals, but now from the Michigan Supreme Court, saying that this is 100% in the right of voters, and that this is an issue that just looks after the redistricting process. And so what this proposal will do is it will remove power from our current legislature and governor, who get to right now be the only ones who decide these decisions. And they will remove that power to an independent citizens commission, where voters can apply and partake in the process from day one. And that's really, I think, what it comes down to, is the reality and the facts behind what is in this proposal and what does it do.
Katie Fahey, Executive Director of Voters Not Politicians. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of the groups that fought Proposal B is the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Its president and CEO, Rich Studley, is with us now. Rich, those legal challenges against Proposal 2 failed at every court level, and two of the justices who ruled to keep the proposal on the November ballot were appointed by Republicans, Justice Viviano and Justice Clement. Why do you think that happened?
Every Michigander has a right to their day in court, especially when there's a serious legal question about a statewide petition drive or ballot proposal. It's especially important for everyone who lives and works in Michigan, whether you're an employee or an employer or a Democrat or Republican or an independent, that the rules that regard ballot proposals are clear. It's not enough just to collect the adequate number of signatures. There are also clear requirements in the law in terms of what kind of proposal can appear on the ballot. The question that was before the Michigan Supreme Court was not whether the redistricting ballot proposal is a good idea or a bad idea. The question before the court was, does this proposal meet the clear requirements in state law and in the Constitution to appear on the ballot in November? We're very disappointed with the decision by the Supreme Court, but what's important for your listeners to understand is that both sides had equal opportunity to present their arguments before the court, and that at the Michigan Chamber, although we are disappointed with the decision, we respect the decision of the courts. The courts have said the proposal is eligible to be on the ballot in November and that the voters should decide, and we understand and accept that position. At the Michigan Chamber, we have confidence in the voters, and we know that when voters are provided with good information, especially about proposed amendments to the state constitution, they'll make good decisions.
Okay, so Rich, as we look ahead to November, now what for the Michigan Chamber?
Our message to voters in November as it regards ballot proposals is the same. Michiganders should study carefully every ballot proposal, especially amendments to the state constitution. We remind voters that the 100-word description they see on the ballot or read about in the newspapers is not the amendment themselves. There are a lot of good resources available, so that people should study the proposals carefully, listen to the arguments for both sides, and then turn out to vote. What's exciting about November is that we'll be electing a new governor, a new attorney general, a new secretary of state. Every member of the state house and the Michigan Senate will be up for election or reelection. So a lot of important races and a lot of important decisions to decide. Redistricting is important to everyone, and it's important that districts are drawn fairly. At the Michigan Chamber, we've always been in favor of the A-poll standards, which were adopted by a democratically controlled Supreme Court to make sure that congressional and legislative districts are drawn fairly. At the Michigan Chamber, we're not in favor of gerrymandering. We understand a lot of Michigan residents want to make changes, and we're very respectful of that. We hope that going forward, we'll have a civil and substantive debate about all of the proposals that appear on the ballot.
How much is the chamber prepared to spend in this campaign against Proposal 2 that'll be coming up for November?
We'll decide later what, if any, role we play in that campaign, and you wouldn't be surprised to hear that we don't talk a lot about campaign strategies or tactics before elections, but I can tell you that we're in the process now of listening to our members. We're member-driven and policy-focused, and for the Michigan Chamber's perspective, we'll have more opportunities and challenges than we have time or money in November, so we'll have to make some decisions later in the year about priorities. And a lot of those decisions we'll make in response to the guidance we receive from our members and cooperation with other groups. Every proposal that's on the ballot will have an impact on employees and employers. There are two or three that are also of concern to the business community because of the impact on the workplace, the proposal to raise the minimum wage, the proposal for paid leave, the proposal to legalize recreational use of marijuana. And so we'll be actively involved in some of those campaigns and maybe not involved at all. But right now, we're just trying to make sure that we understand and reflect on the Supreme Court decision. And we understand a lot of Michiganders want to make changes to how we approach redistricting. And so we accept the decision of the court. They have said it's time to let the voters decide, and we'll be very respectful about it.
Rich, what are you hearing from your members today? I know it's early since the announcement of the ruling. What are you hearing from members?
It is early. The decision was released last night at 10:30. And so I think to be fair to the court, we need to take time to reflect on the decision, to understand the substance. And again, the legal question that we raised was, does this proposal meet the requirements to appear on the ballot? And so, this is the process, and we go forward into the fall. Michigan is still a great place to live and work and do business, and we're optimistic about the state's future.
Rich Studley, President and CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Rich, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Gladly.
Up next, we dive back in history to learn about Michigander Harriet Quimby, the very first woman licensed to fly in the U.S. And then we hear why Granite Island out in Lake Superior could help NASA learn about global climate change. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know what that means. It's time to talk our state's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Today, the story of a Michigan woman who a century ago soared above the patriarchy and the restrictions placed on women of her era. It was on this day in 1911, Arcadia Township's Harriet Quimby became the first female pilot licensed in the nation. Here with us now is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and from the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation, Matt Anderson, who's curator of transportation. Rachel, I'm going to start with you. Everyone knows the name Amelia Earhart, and I dare say most people have not heard of Harriet Quimby, who blazed the trail for Earhart. Exactly where did she grow up in Michigan, and what was her early life like?
So Harriet Quimby grew up in Arcadia, Michigan, up in Manistee County. She was, by all reports, born up there, except her death certificate actually indicates that she was born in California in 1885. But in reality, she was born in Michigan in 1875. And her family were farmers. Her father was a farmer. And somewhere between 1880 and 1884, they moved to California.
Okay. And Matt, aviation was just, an infant at the turn of the last century. So do we know how Harriet Quimby became involved in this new form of transportation?
Yeah, she became interested in aviation the way a lot of folks did in the first years of the 20th century by attending an air show. She had gone to Belmont Park in New York in October of 1910 and saw the Moisant family flying, or their flying circus, and was just kind of captivated by the whole experience. And being clever, she convinced her editors at Leslie's to pay for her to get flying lessons, something like $750. And in exchange, she agreed to write a series of articles about her experiences learning to fly and then being a pilot as well. So she earned her license in August of 1911 and was the first U.S. woman to earn a license.
So she was actually a journalist getting sent out on stories. You just never know what you're going to discover that might change your life.
Absolutely.
Rachel, when I think about this time, so here we're saying 1911 when she got her license. At that time, most women in this country were not even allowed to vote. So do we know if she faced obstacles because of her gender and her pursuit of aviation?
She did. There was a lot of skepticism of how well a woman would be able to fly. I mean, there was still skepticism about how well women could drive. So putting a woman in a plane was viewed as a little dangerous. But her flying spoke for itself. When she first started, she would wear a veil to try to hide her gender. But she was very good at flying. And so once she got through some of her tests, it was seen that women actually can fly, and she was very good.
So, Matt, besides becoming the first licensed female pilot in America, how did Harriet Quimby make a name for herself in the aviation world?
Yeah, Quimby was not only a gifted flyer, but she also had, a natural talent for self-promotion, which is a good thing in a pilot in this era. She had adopted a kind of a custom-made costume made of purple satin with wool underneath that she would wear, had a hood on it as well, and was really quite a striking ensemble. And a lot of people took note of that, particularly a lot of newspapers wrote about it, and she made it her trademark and really helped her establish herself. And she also flew a number of air shows as well as a stunt pilot. And in fact, not long after she got her license, she made the first night flight made by a woman in the U.S. Over Staten Island. So things like that helped draw attention to her feats.
And Rachel, she was also at the same time making her way into the brand new film industry in Hollywood?
She was. She was a drama editor for Leslie's Weekly Illustrated, and she ended up writing a couple of screenplays and even appeared in one of her own films. So she did get into Hollywood.
Okay, Matt, take us to the sorry end to Harriet's career and life.
Yes, 1912 would be both the peak of her career and unfortunately, the early end of it. In the fall of 1911, she had first started toying around with the idea of flying over the English Channel, which had only been done for the first time by anyone in 1909, and she thought she might make a name for herself as the first woman to do so. So, again, she goes to England and convinces a British paper to put up the money to support the endeavor. She manages to find a plane, goes to Dover, and gets ready to fly the Channel, and people are trying to talk her out of it right up until the last minute, and I think that kind of doubt just further encouraged her to make this happen. She was not going to stop, and she went out, she made the flight, and it landed, took up her just a little over an hour, and she flew 22 miles in fog most of the time, kind of depending on a compass to make the flight, which she had never used before, so a lot of courage, but she made it successfully. Really, that made her the most famous female pilot in the world at that point. She was now at the peak of her profession. In fact, she was going to be paid $100,000, which was an enormous sum at the time, to fly at an air show in Boston. And it was there on July 1st that she was doing some flights before the show, flying with the sponsor, William Willard. And for reasons that are still unknown to this day, as they were flying out over the bay there off Boston, the plane pitched forward. And it was first Mr. Willard who was thrown from the plane in his falling out, shifted the balance of the plane so much that Quimby was just unable to regain control of it until she herself was thrown out of the plane as well. And sadly, both of them died at that moment.
As you say, thrown out from the plane, Matt, were seatbelts just something that were not even conceivable to people in 1912?
Yeah, we sit here now and we wonder how on earth could they not have thought to wear seatbelts? But we could ask the same about people in automobiles. I mean, seatbelts weren't commonly used until the 60s or even later that people were actually using them. And I think there were just different schools of thought. The planes were fairly flimsy at this time, so there weren't a lot of places to secure or anchor a seatbelt. And there were also some people who thought that it was just safer to be thrown out of the wreck or to get out of an airplane if it caught on fire or something, rather than to be strapped down to it. So for whatever reason, they just weren't wearing them, though. That would, of course, change before too long.
So she broke down. She kind of kicked open the door. How long before more women began to follow her along that pathway of aviation and getting a pilot's license, Matt?
It would not be very long. In fact, she went through school with Mathilde Moisan, who was in the group there that she first saw that inspired her to take up flight. She got her license right after Harriet Quimby. Then others would follow in her path. And, of course, Amelia Earhart, probably still the most famous female pilot anywhere in the world. But Harriet Quimby, despite her short life and her premature death, really had an enormous impact and got women interested in flying. And she's to be credited for realizing from the start that there was much more to flying than just these kinds of stunt shows. She sadly didn't live to see it, but she knew at some point commercial aviation would become commonplace and flight would be an everyday experience.
The story of Harriet Quimby of Arcadia Township. On this day in 1911, she became the first female pilot licensed in the nation and certainly broke a lot of norms for the age. And in the process, open doors for women to follow into aviation. Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and from the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation, the curator of transportation, Matt Anderson. Both of you, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
NASA has cast its research eye on a little island in Lake Superior. It sits about 12 miles northwest of Marquette, Granite Island. It's the focus of NASA research that could help us understand the way clouds and aerosol particles in the atmosphere affect global climate change. NASA is working with Northern Michigan University on the project, and John Lenners is part of that. He is a research associate at Northern and one of the investigators. Good to have you with us, John.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us about this NASA network that the Granite Island site is a part of.
Well, they have a number of sites around the country and actually around the world that measure solar radiation or the amount of sunlight coming from the sky and also infrared radiation coming from the sky and the clouds. And part of the reason for these sites is they're used to validate satellite measurements. So many of the satellites that NASA runs measure similar variables from the sun and from the clouds, and in order to get an assessment of whether they're correct or not, you need similar measurements on the ground. So that's partly why they put the sensors up at Granite Island as part of their Clouds and Earth's Radiant Energy System Satellite Validation, or SERES, project.
Okay, so that ground data kind of corroborates what it is the satellites are indicating.
Exactly, right. And they're also used to measure things like long-term variations in sunshine and other radiation that's received at the Earth's surface, which obviously modifies our weather and climate.
Now, I got to say, John, when people hear you use that word radiation, I think a lot of minds will jump immediately to nuclear radiation. But so talk to us a little more. Break down what radiation means in this context.
Well, radiation spans a whole range of wavelengths, from very harmful wavelengths like ultraviolet and even higher frequency than that. But, I mean, we're inundated with radiation all day long from the sun, from infrared radiation that we can feel and keeps us warm. So there's plenty of radiation that's not necessarily directly dangerous to humans and, in fact, is really important for driving our weather and climate.
And why are these measurements being taken on Granite Island important in understanding the role of clouds and aerosols and their effect on climate change?
Well, part of the reason for the selection of that site was because it's located far from land. And so when the satellites are looking down at the Earth, oftentimes they get a lot of clutter from all the variability that's going on the land, like changes in land cover due to forests and urban areas, water areas. But when you go over a water area, you don't have all that clutter. And so what they're seeing from the satellite is pretty much just a wide open expanse of Lake Superior. So if they see any variability in their measurements, that almost for sure reflects some kind of changes in cloud cover or aerosols, which are precisely what they're interested in measuring, not all the clutter on the ground. So that's the main reason they chose an overwater site. They had another one off of Chesapeake Bay, and that one was decommissioned for safety reasons, so they needed another overwater site. They were also really interested because it's part of the Great Lakes Evaporation Network, and this is a number of sites on the Great Lakes, two of which are on Superior, Standard Rock Lighthouse and Granite Island Lighthouse. Those have been in operation since 2008 to measure other aspects of the lake energy balance, so things like lake evaporation and other heat fluxes that are of use for this Ceres project by NASA as well.
John, give us an understanding of what current science says on the relationship between the role of clouds and aerosols and how they affect climate change. What's that relationship?
Well, I can give you one really good example, and that's something known as global dimming or global brightening. A lot of people have probably heard of global warming.
Yes.
And that's, you know, related to the increase of the greenhouse effect due to fossil fuel burning and CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases like water vapor in the atmosphere. But on top of global warming, we've had something known as global brightening and global dimming. And this was first understood back in early 80s when they started seeing changes in the Earth's radiation received at the surface and understanding that it was related to pollutants in the atmosphere. So we've been putting pollutants in the atmosphere for quite some time. And when that happened, it reflected more sunlight and made the Earth less warm than it would have been because of global warming. So there was a tailing off of global warming back in the 50s and 60s. Some people refer to that as like the big cooling back in the 70s. It wasn't really cooling globally. It was just tailing off of the global warming process. Well, in the 80s, we started to clean up our act and removed a lot of the pollutants and aerosols from the atmosphere, and global warming started to take off like mad, basically taking the cap off by letting more sunlight down at the Earth's surface. So it basically amplified what was already happening with global warming. And this is a process that it's not fully understood. Some places the global brightening is due to changes in cloud cover. Other places it's due to changes in aerosols and pollutants. And so we're trying to get a better handle on that. And one of the reasons we're really interested in that for Lake Superior is it's warming very rapidly. It's one of the most rapidly warming lakes on the planet. And part of the reason for that is because of increased sunshine in the summertime, there's been less cloud cover over the upper Great Lakes region over the years, and the reasons for that aren't fully understood. But we do know that that increased brightening at the surface is leading to more rapid warming than we are expecting just simply from global warming.
Boy, when you think of cause and effect and how intertwined things are, I can see where it really is a heavy lift for research to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, the sun is like the big elephant in the sky that sometimes just gets ignored. And unfortunately, radiation measurements like this are relatively rare compared to other basic weather stations that measure temperature and wind and precipitation. So we really need a better network of measurements of radiation at the Earth's surface to understand the effects of clouds and aerosols.
Well, John Letters, you mentioned that you're a part of the Great Lakes Evaporation Network, and I know that takes measurements on Granite Island, and that data will help provide a complete picture of the region's energy budget. Can you explain for us just what an energy budget is and its importance in regulating climate?
Sure. The surface energy budget, for example, the Great Lakes, is basically an accounting of all the energy coming into and out of the lake and how that changes the energy within the lake, which is mostly just the temperature of the water. It's sort of like an accounting that you would do of your own personal checking account. You figure out how much money is coming in, how much money is going out, and the difference is your change in balance. And so we have that same thing going on in the Great Lakes. They get the vast majority of their energy from the sun and from the sky. That's called shortwave radiation and infrared radiation. And they release energy by radiation as well, emitting infrared radiation up to the sky. And then what's left over are a couple other processes. Evaporation is a cooling process, as we all know. You know, if you get your skin wet in the summertime and you step outside in the wind, you cool off really rapidly. So the lakes sweat in a sense as well. They lose their energy partly by evaporation. And also something known as sensible heat flux, which is just basically the wind moving over warm water. If the air is cool, the lake will lose heat that way. And so you account for all the amount of energy going into and out of the lake, and what's left over is the change in heat stored in the lake, and that's generally measured by buoys. So we have temperature sensors on buoys, many of which measure temperatures throughout the depth of the lake, so from the top down to the bottom. And if you have enough of those, you can get a sense of what the change in heat storage in the lake is. So all these different processes affect the water temperature, they affect processes like evaporation, and they even affect our weather because these lakes are so big that the temperature differences you get between the land and the water can drive things like lake effect snowfall and lake breezes in the summertime and things like that.
John, ultimately, when you think of the research you're doing now on Granite Island, this little island in Lake Superior, working with NASA, what do you hope this research will lead to?
For one thing, I hope it leads to a much better understanding of how our Great Lakes are affected by weather and climate and how we might expect them to be affected in the future. There's really quite a scarcity of observations over the Great Lakes because they are so large, and you know, some of these sites are really hard to access, especially ones like Standard Rock, which is 24 miles from the nearest land point. And so getting observations over the lake, even just to make a basic weather forecast for that day for mariners, you know, to get a good wind and wave forecast, is really difficult without having good observations out on the lake. So we hope that this collaboration with NASA will lead to certainly better observations of radiation and cloud cover and aerosols and how that affects the lakes and the climate.
John Lenters is a researcher with Northern Michigan University. John, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Up next, the last installation of Irredeemable, a series from Interlochen Public Radio about juvenile lifers in Michigan. This time, we meet Chester Patterson and the family of Rick Tholen, the man Patterson killed.
If he is paroled someday, then I am trusting the people who know way better than I do that he could no longer be a threat to society.
That is up next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our next story is part of Interlochen Public Radio's series Irredeemable about juvenile lifers in Michigan. In the 70s, a store clerk was shot and killed in Grand Rapids. The story was in the newspapers for a while, and then coverage ended. But for the man who murdered the store clerk and the victim's family members, the story continues. IPR's Morgan Springer met the family at their home in Traverse City.
Okay, and this is...
Well, yeah.
That's the children.
That's me, Dan, and Rick, and our dog.
1968.
Dan Tholen sits in the dining room at his house in Traverse City. He and his sister are looking at old family photographs, mostly of their brother. Their brother was killed nearly 50 years ago.
That son of a gun didn't get to get old like us. Look at that. He gets to be this. Where is that baby?
This.
Yeah.
Nancy Sweeney holds up the picture. Their brother is young, handsome, and shirtless at the beach. He's lounging on a yellow towel and squinting at the camera.
Oh, come on. That's our baby oil commercial.
His name was Rick Tholen. Nancy says Rick was a lot of things. Dedicated to teaching, athletic, not perfect, but a good guy. She says he was also a ladies' man who sometimes had multiple girlfriends at once.
We had one in the living room and one in the kitchen at the same time.
Are you joking?
No. You're not joking. I would help bounce back and forth.
Rick was killed in 1970. It was a December evening, and he was working at M&J Grocery Store in Grand Rapids. He was in his first year of teaching high school English, and he'd picked up some extra shifts over Christmas break. It was around 10 p.m.
A robber came in, took money from the till, and shot him.
Rick was 22. It was 4 days before Christmas.
I mean, one thing, I remember sitting there staring at the tree thinking, well, maybe we should remove his presence from under the tree. And did, so my mom wouldn't have to.
This is a story about what happened to the man who killed Rick, Chester Patterson. It's also a story about lies and forgiveness. I spoke with Chester by phone when he was at Ionia Correctional Facility. He's 64 now. Back when he robbed the party store and killed Rick, he was 17. He dropped out of school and was messing around with heroin and alcohol. He said he robbed the store because he needed money to buy a drink. And were you drunk or high when it happened?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't. Why did you shoot him? You already had the money, right?
Yes. I thought he would be able to identify me since I lived in the neighborhood. And that's what I was scared of.
Do you remember what you were thinking after it happened?
I was scared and shocked at what I had done. because I found out later on the news that he had died. And I was pretty tore up about that.
After that, Chester was convicted of murder and he got a life sentence. And unlike other people we've profiled in this series, he's been eligible for parole. He was first eligible after 10 years, but the first 10 years passed, then 20, 30, and 47 years later, he was still in prison.
Like they say, you have to lay in the bed that you make. I made a very hard bed, and that's what I have to lay in.
Barbara Levine is the former executive director of CAPS, or Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. She says in the 80s and the 90s, parolable lifers like Chester were rarely released. But in recent years, she says things have changed.
Now you've got several hundred, I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but it's well over 200 lifers who've been paroled in the last 10, 12 years now. And their recidivism rate is almost nil. I mean, you've got a 3, 4, 5 people who've come back.
Chester has a bachelor's degree. He's a paralegal, and it's been nearly 20 years since he got written up in prison, but still no parole. And Chester has a theory why. He says it's because he was not honest about what actually happened that day. Nancy Sweeney would put it differently. She says Chester's lied for years about how he killed her brother.
He maintained that it was an accident, that he fired his weapon as he left the store, and that it struck our brother in the head and killed him, and that he didn't know that he had committed that crime until he heard it on the news later that night. And we all knew it wasn't true.
Nancy says forensic evidence showed Chester shot Rick in the head, execution style.
Oh, let's see. What exactly did I say? Because it's been so long, and I don't have a confession, a copy of it.
Right.
They asked me about it. I told them that I robbed a store and I fired a shot. And that was enough for them to charge me.
And is it true, had you said that your gun had misfired as you were going out the door? Like, didn't you say to them what you just said to me?
No, I didn't. What did I say? I shot through the counter. I can't remember the exact words, but I did not say that I shot him. No, I didn't.
And did they ask you and you denied it?
Yes.
Chester maintained it was an accident until he had a commutation hearing in 2010. Nancy describes how he came clean.
He was badgered heavily by the parole board to do it. He was pretty much told, and my husband and I were there hearing it, that this was his last chance. They were tired of hearing his lies, that they told him they knew he was lying. And I mean, finger in the face, bully type conversations he had to go through.
One parole board member said to Chester, quote, "All of the things that you've done in prison since 1996, when you started to get your act together, don't mean anything to me because you won't tell the truth."
He finally broke down and said, okay, yeah, that's what I did.
Chester admitted he shot Rick on purpose, not by accident. Chester says his reasons for lying changed over time. First, he says he was ashamed to tell his mother he had shot and killed someone intentionally. Then, after he told his mother, he says it was too hard in public hearings to tell Nancy Sweeney how he killed her brother.
Well, for me to sit there and drag her through that and make her relive that instant when I pulled the trigger, it's hard for me to do, and it's not like I'm not taking responsibility, because I've definitely taken full responsibility.
Chester says he learned his lesson at the 2010 hearing, and if he gets another parole hearing, he'll describe exactly how he killed Rick Tholen. He says it was a mistake he made as a kid.
You know, there was no sense to it. There was no reason for it. But I'm not that person anymore. You know, now you're dealing with virtually a senior citizen that's fully remorseful and sorry for the hurt that I've caused. And I would like their forgiveness.
It's not my job. Nope, I don't need to forgive him. One way or another, what happens to him happens to him. And I don't hate him. I don't need to forgive him. I just need to know that if he's out, he's a contributing member to society and not going to cause anybody else any other anxiety.
I think he's asked in his letter if we would forgive him, but that's too trite of an expression. It just doesn't work. I'm not carrying any burden from it except for missing my brother. It's not eating me up. Anger isn't eating either of us up. So I don't know. That's one level of forgiveness right there, to let it go so it doesn't continue to destroy our lives.
Over the past 47 years, letting it go has been Dan Tholen's approach. He hasn't really kept up with Chester's progress or whereabouts. Nancy, on the other hand, has been keeping close track of Chester, and when there are public parole hearings, she goes.
I go to the hearings to put our brother in a 3D mode. I don't like the fact that Chester's letters are there and his physical presence is there, his wishes, his dreams, his hopes, and Rick is a one-liner store clerk that was in the wrong place at the wrong time and met the wrong people. So I feel like it's my job to introduce that board to the man that can't live and can't say he wants out.
I worry for Nancy mostly in that she's carrying a lot of pain. And it is difficult to do this, to face Chester and to face the issue. And I admire her for doing it, but I hope she can get over the pain.
Do you feel pain, as Dan's kind of saying, or how do you feel?
I miss what's not there. You know, I've said it before, I would have loved to have seen him have a family. I would have loved him to be another nice uncle to our child. So that is my pain. Chester Patterson is not my pain.
Dan says when it comes to Chester's parole, he trusts the legal system to make the right choice. Nancy is almost with him.
On this, we agree a good 90%. If I'm with Dan, if he is paroled someday, then I am trusting the people who know way better than I do that he could no longer be a threat to society. I currently don't hold that opinion after the two hearings I've been to and listened to him. I just don't know how you rehab yourself if you go that long telling yourself a lie.
After I interviewed Dan and Nancy this spring, Chester had his third public parole hearing. They were both there. And this time, Chester Patterson was granted parole. The parole board said they were reasonably sure he was no longer a public safety threat. Both Nancy and Dan say they expected this would happen eventually. Dan says for him, it's not a big deal. For Nancy, she says she doesn't feel great about it, but she hopes Chester can be an instrument of good in the world. Chester was released from prison at the end of July at 64 years old. For Stateside, I'm Morgan Springer.
That story is part of Interlochen Public Radio's series Irredeemable, about juvenile lifers in Michigan. You can listen to more stories from this series by going to irredeemable.org. And you can check out pictures of Rick Tholen and Chester Patterson while you're there. Each year, Native American kids can enjoy a summer youth culture camp experience. It happens at the Pokagon Band's Rogers Lake campus. Many of the camp activities are built around cultural teachings, and a big part of that is telling stories passed down through generations. The story you are about to hear in our ongoing campfire series is told by Colin Wiesaw. He often tells stories at Camp Kagabeshman in Dowagiac, stories he heard growing up. Wiesaw is a tribal elder leader with the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. And here he is talking about the importance of stories in his culture.
I want people to feel comfortable, so I give them a little history of why I tell stories or how I tell them. What I usually do is tell them I'm 63 years old now. I started telling stories when I was 18 years old. I heard my father tell stories when I was 18, and it was, for me, it was an eye-opener. I was looking for a way to express how beautiful our culture, the Native culture, is. And when I seen him tell stories, I thought that was the way to go. So I started to learn stories from him and from other elders that I ran into along the way of my life. And one of the things that they used to tell me is to listen. Listen to the stories. They're not stories. They're pathways. These are teachings that our people passed down. Once upon a time, a long time ago, there was a little boy. This boy was good. He was well-liked throughout the village. He was about 9-10 years old. He was a good child. Everybody loved him. His friends all loved him because they knew he had a kind, giving heart. One day, that child woke up, and he had this thought about going down to his private little getaway spot where he would just go sit and think about everything that evolved in his life. So he quickly got dressed, and when he raised the flap to his lodge, he noticed that there was frost on the ground from the night before. So he decided to take this old beat-up deer trail. It was going to lead him down there a lot quicker and stay off the regular path. And as he moved down that deer trail, he noticed something laying across it. He paid it no attention. He thought he recognized what it was, and he began to walk with caution, placing every foot down so carefully, so quietly, not a creature could hear him in the entire forest. And when he was ready to cross that object, a wonderful thing happened. That object looked at him, and it spoke to him. It said, "Little boy, pick me up and hold me close to your body so I can live again." That boy looked at that object. He said, "You're a snake. You're a rattlesnake. If I pick you up and hold you, you're going to bite me, and then I'll die." That snake looked at him and said, "Oh, please, little boy, the warmth from your body will keep me alive. Please, I won't bite you. Please, I promise." That boy started to quickly think about everything he loved in his life. He started to think about his friends, his parents and all their friends and the elders in the village. And then he looked into the forest and he thought about all the animals that live there and how much he loved life and how much he hated death. He bent down and he picked that old snake up and he held it close to his arms. He started, whap! That snake just bit him right in the eye. That boy dropped that snake. He cried, he screamed, he said, "Why? Why have you bitten me? You said if I picked you up and held you, you wouldn't bite me. And now I'm going to die. Why?" As that snake moved off, he turned back and he looked at that little boy. He said, "Little boy, you knew what I was when you picked me up. You know what I am." As I tell the people that I tell this story to, how many of you think you're intelligent? How many of you think you know right from wrong? The story's talking about right from wrong. How many of you had a friend or are the friend that said, "Come on, let's go do this," knowing in your heart it's wrong, but you do it anyways? 90% of the time you get in trouble. You have the same power to stop your friend from doing something wrong. It's your choice in life. And that's the story of the boy and the snake.
Colin Wiesaw was recently elected to be the elders' representative for the Pokagon Band's Tribal Council. His campfire story about the boy and the snake will be archived on our website, michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Tune into Stateside tomorrow as we discuss the value of both having a mentor and being a mentor.
Yeah, there's a phrase I learned years and years ago. I think it was when I was in early graduate school, and that is, you don't own it till you can give it away.
We'll discuss the do's and don'ts of mentorship next time and introduce you to a brand new series, which we're unveiling tomorrow. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Joey Horan. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.